not be passive. Doing nothing is not an option. Starve your cancer. Stop it spreading. Snuff it out. Hello, brand new you. It is in the nature of revolution, the overturning of an existing order, that at its inception, a very small number of people are involved. The process, in fact, begins with one person and an idea that persuades a second, then a third, and a fourth, and gathers force until the idea is successfully contradicted, absorbed into conventional wisdom, or actually turns the world upside down. A revolution requires not only ammunition, but also weapons and men willing to use them and willing to be slain in the battle. In an intellectual revolution, there must be ideas and advocates willing to challenge an entire profession, the establishment itself, willing to spend their reputations and careers in spreading the idea through deeds as well as words. Jude Wernisky, The Way the World Works, Touchstone Books, 1978. Join my revolution. Spread the word. Research articles, podcasts, interviews, blogs from survivors will be on my website, www.howtostarvecancer.com. Lively discussions, peer-reviewed medical articles to download, inspirational patients, my Facebook family. www.facebook.com/groups/off.label.drugsforcancer. Part 1. The Discovery of My Metabolic Protocol. Chapter 1. Maracas.
Come on, wake up! I heard the words faintly as I tried to open my eyes. I had had another fractious night, taunted by nightmares. Just as I had finally fallen into a deep sleep, someone was nudging me awake.
It's 6 o'clock, you need to get up. We have to get down to the coast by 8.
My husband, Andrew, gave me another affectionate prod.
Okay, I'm moving, I lied.
Then I remembered why I had to get up. I was going racing. I grinned in the dark, excited but still groggy. I pulled the covers off and headed to the bathroom. The last time I had sailed with the team, in a reckless attempt to lead a normal life, I hadn't yet finished my 6 months of chemotherapy. I had not been fit enough. During the first race, I had very nearly thrown up all over the spinnaker, and my arms had felt like lead while I packed it into a sail bag down below. I hoped I would feel better this time. I desperately needed to feel better. 9 months earlier, in the summer of 1999, I had been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. Nearly 5 years after the primary cancer was diagnosed in my cervix, it had spread to my lungs. My illness and the relentless rounds of chemotherapy had led to my spending the winter hibernating, struggling to get through each day. Now I was emerging with the spring, making a conscious effort to fight the exhaustion that drained my strength. I had decided that a bit of exercise might fight the fatigue away. Grabbing my Ziploc bags of supplements from the kitchen, all botanical extracts apart from a low-dose aspirin, I headed for the door, stuffing them deep into a pocket out of sight. Andrew was waiting at the wheel of the car, and I slid gratefully into the passenger seat. It takes an hour and a half to drive to Lymington. Perhaps I could catch a few more Zeds on the way. Trying to swallow supplements while on chemotherapy had been difficult. I had ignored my oncologist's advice not to take anything at all, and had done my own research. Some supplements like EGCG from green tea and curcumin found in turmeric enhanced chemotherapy. Now that I had finished those dreadful infusions, the number of supplements I was taking had skyrocketed. I wanted all the help I could get, and they might just make the difference. When we arrived, the crew were gathered on the dock. My friend Lue was carrying an armful of T-shirts. Everyone in the 12-strong team was handed one with his or her crew nickname on the back. My husband opened his, emblazoned with his nickname, Spotter. With his boat nerd ability, he can instantly tell from a distance the make, model, and engine size of any boat, as well as who built her, when, and how well. Yawn. I giggled and wondered nervously what Lue had in store for me. Jane, this one's for you, he said with a grin. As I turned the shirt over, I saw it. Maracas. I laughed. Damn it, I thought you hadn't noticed all the pills. Lue looked at me incredulously. You have to be joking. We've all seen those little Ziploc packets you take everywhere and that green muck you drink. If you were trying to hide it, you failed miserably. Bother, I hadn't been quite as discreet as I thought. These pills and the green drink, what I like to call my primordial soup, were my lifeline. I had wanted to keep my illness a secret, a private nightmare. It was unfair to drag anyone else into it. I was terrified about my future, which, if I listened to the medics, would be extremely short. But how ridiculous to think I could hide anything from 12 crewmates on a 48-foot boat. There were no secrets, no matter how hard I tried. Mixing up the daily drink, spirulina, chlorella, and all manner of pulverized shrubbery, and organizing daily sachets of supplements took some time. But it was a small price to pay for getting out of the house and living a bit. It was surviving. Please, God, I silently prayed, don't let this be my life forever. It was so hard to stay upbeat and positive with all the uncertainty. I hated drawing attention to my problems. I couldn't bear the thought of my teammates treating me as an invalid and someone to be pitied. I wanted to continue to be Jane, their rugged and quirky sailing buddy. I wanted them to joke with me as they always did, not to ask anxiously how I was feeling. I understand that some people are proud of their chemotherapy baldness and lymphedema stockings. Their surgery scars are badges of honor. Not me. I just couldn't see it that way. My mild right leg lymphedema, caused by extensive surgery to remove my lymph nodes, remained hidden under long skirts and trousers. Fortunately, unless I pointed it out, most people didn't even notice. And when my hair fell out with all the chemo, I did not wear a scarf or hat. Too obvious. I wanted to look as normal as possible. Even though they were unbearably itchy, I wore wigs, partly because I wanted to deny even to myself that anything was wrong, and partly because even I was shocked when I caught sight of my hair-free noggin in the bathroom mirror. It made me catch my breath. Even after several months, the horror at my reflection hadn't got any easier. As soon as my hair had started to drop out in great big handfuls, I had rushed out and bought some decent wigs and Selfridges. I bought 3 at once, in 3 different styles. When I wanted to feel glamorous, I could wear the long, wavy wig. Sporty? The bob. Every day? The mid-length straight hair. Which wife would you like today? I would ask Andrew as I got dressed in the morning. It certainly confused the builders who were extending our attic at the time, when I came downstairs with short hair one day and long hair the next. I used the shortest wig for sailing, because it was easier to wedge on under my cap. Sailing was my passion. It was helping me to keep my sanity when I was perilously close to despair. Being so surrounded by a team of close buddies, laughing at each other's stories and competing in intense racing, was a help, even if only for the briefest time. The activity and friendship took my mind off the pain, disfigurement, and the loss of who I once was. And death. I was desperate to believe that this was not my last season racing on the boat. While I was thoroughly exhausted by my treatments, I was keen to pretend that nothing out of the ordinary was happening. It was business as usual. I forced myself to carry on sailing, although on race mornings I wanted nothing more than to dive back under the bedclothes.
Once out with the team, I insisted on throwing myself into the action on board, despite some crewmates' concerns that I wasn't up to it. With the benefit of hindsight, I realized that this might have been selfish, slowing the team down. I was taking much longer to get myself back up on the rail and to keep the boat level. Upwind, I would be down below, packing the enormous spinnaker, usually on my own. It can be awkward packing a sail the size of a tennis court into a few feet of space, especially when the boat is constantly changing direction, keeling over at a 45-degree angle. It was exhausting, even if you weren't poorly, particularly if it had got wet. When we reached the top mark and turned the boat to run downwind, I was the trimmer, constantly checking the set of the spinnaker, ensuring that we were sailing as fast as possible. I loved the feeling of exertion, the wind on my face, the ozone, and the sting of the spray as the boat cut through the water in a gentle sway. It soothed my worries. This game of chess on the water, working out the shifting wind directions and the tides. Tactics and strategy were more Andrew's field, but all of us on board needed to be aware of where we were and what we needed to do to get ahead and stay there, and to prepare for sudden manoeuvres. Sailing has been in my blood for generations. My father owned a succession of boats in Guernsey where I grew up. Sailing on a little 26-foot yacht with my elder sister Susie was one of my earliest memories. We mostly cruised around the other Channel Islands, especially Herm and Sark, but some summers we nipped over to Saint-Malo in Brittany, on the northwestern coastline of France. It was a heavenly childhood, one I associated with sparkling seas and stunning island beaches. Even amidst the frantic activity during a race, there would be moments of quiet and calm, with just the soothing sound of the waves as a backdrop. I would often become lost in thought, trying to recapture that long-lost stress-free feeling of pure bliss from my youth. It was gratitude tinged with sadness that my love of sailing, the sea, and of life itself might soon come to an untimely end. In my teens, I had been desperate to take a more active part in yacht racing. Sailing with my father was immensely frustrating because he was very old-fashioned and never let me touch any winches or ropes. I was a girl, after all. Eventually, I gave up, worked during the holidays, saved up, and bought myself a windsurfer instead. I loved the challenge of learning this new skill, and I became a total surfing bum, never off the beach in the summer. But the competitive spirit inside me still wanted to race boats. The opportunity came in the form of a lovely sailing boat called a swage, affectionately known as Sausage by our opposition. A swage was a 42-foot swan, a boat known for its solid yet streamlined design, the perfect marriage of safe cruising and speed. She'd come over to Guernsey to compete in the Swan European Sailing Championships in the early 1990s, and she needed one more crew member. I leapt at the opportunity. Once I was on board, they weren't getting rid of me. Sailing on a swage was brilliant fun. For years, my weekends and holidays were taken up racing around the south coast of England. I was also lucky enough to sail in Antigua, Majorca, and Sardinia, and to compete in many offshore races to France, even in the notorious Fastnet race. My uncle had drowned during that race in the Great Storm of 1979, so I had always been reluctant to enter. By the time I talked myself into it, our team had racked up an impressive list of trophies. It was still a hobby, but a complete contrast to my day job as a chartered physiotherapist with the seriously ill. I had initially worked in neurology. Much of my time was spent rehabilitating people who had suffered head injuries and strokes. I helped them relearn how to use their bodies, to move their hands and legs. It had been physically demanding. Later, I specialized in orthopedics and sports injuries. Many high-level athletes became dependent on my expertise. Despite sailing with Andrew for many years on a swage, it had taken us ages to get together. He hadn't liked my former boyfriend, and I hadn't liked his former girlfriend.